This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. 4 years ago, I went to the Olympics, and I had a wonderful time. Let's understand that up front. Now we're into another edition of the Games, and before we turn to the good stuff, we've got a story about some of what happens in a host city before the running, jumping, swimming, and soccer playing begin, and after the athletes have gone home. We'll start with Rio de Janeiro, since that's what you'll be seeing on TV for the next couple of weeks. But to some extent, the plot of our story has played out in lots of host cities, one of which may surprise you. Anyway, in Rio, up until a decade or so ago, there were lots worse places to live than Villa Autódromo. It's a community, a favela. The Portuguese word doesn't necessarily mean slum. This favela, like a lot of them, had grown in fits and starts. When the residents, some of whom had claimed the land generations ago, had a little money, they bought some lumber or hauled some stones up the hill to improve the homes they'd built, overlooking what would one day become Rio's Olympic Park. Dave Zirin, the author of Brazil's Dance with the Devil, visited Villa Autódromo when it was thriving. He was especially taken with a resident named Armando.
Well, Armando was just one of many people who welcomed me into his home. You see, when people learned that there was some media there, they became very proud. They were like, hey, tell our story, tell our story.
Zirin has been to Brazil half a dozen times over the past 5 years. Developers and Olympic planners characterized the favela as an eyesore that needed to be raised, but that wasn't what Zirin found.
People were incredibly friendly. People were playing chess and checkers underneath shaded trees. It was a place where elderly people felt comfortable being outside, and there was no evidence of anybody feeling unsafe. Some of the homes were really nice, were built up. I went inside a bunch. They were wired for internet. But they might be next door to a home that was crumbling or a home that was basically like a squatter shelter. So it was a lot of uneven development block to block.
Once Rio won the right to host the 2014 World Cup and then the 2016 Summer Olympics, it became apparent that a neighborhood characterized by uneven development block to block wasn't going to cut it. Rio was the capital of a nation riding a growth spurt. Brazil was booming, the boom was to include the games, and there was no place in the presentation of those games for those checker-playing neighbors on land the developers had been coveting for decades.
And the poor in Rio know that these events are not for them. They're for the global elite and the Rio elite and the Brazilian elite.
Researcher Christopher Gaffney lived in Brazil from 2009 until 2015. As a member of a social movement working to preserve human rights in the face of mega events, he studied the impact of the World Cup and the Olympics on Rio. Gaffney witnessed the gradual and then not so gradual attempt by the authorities to make Villa Autódromo disappear.
Where you go in and you give money to one person to leave, you go and destroy their house, you leave the rubble, and then their neighbors have their property devalued because there's rubble that hasn't been cleaned and rats, and you know, you're living in a place that looks like it was hit by a bomb.
Or lots of bombs and some wrecking balls. But at night, you can't see broken stone and piles of garbage the city has stopped collecting because the city has also stopped turning on the streetlights. When he last visited Villa Autódromo, slated to become luxury housing, Dave Zirin barely recognized the neighborhood.
When I was just back in May, of the something like 700 homes that were there, roughly, there are about 23 homes left, and everything else is just rubble.
None of those homes belong to Armando.
There was an effort for us to keep in touch, but where his home was, which was, again, like this very well-built place, was rubble. And I have no idea where Armando is now.
Some of the other former residents of the favela had been moved to neighborhoods impossibly distant from their work. Some of the displaced had left quietly, resigned to their fates. Others had fought the evictions and resisted the police. For all of them, the result was the same.
I mean, it ended with more people getting fearful that if they don't take the government's deal now, the government will find a way to just kick them on the streets for nothing. And so it led to more people taking the deal.
Some residents received compensation. Some were relocated. Some got nothing.
It's a bad deal. Like from this home that you've built up by yourself to what amounts to an apartment building in an area that feels much less safe and much less community oriented.
It is so much worse.
That's Anita Beatty, but she isn't talking about Rio. Rio isn't the only place Olympics-driven displacement has happened. It can happen here, and it did. Anita Beatty is the executive director of the Metro Atlanta Task Force for the Homeless, and she's talking about what happened before the juggernaut of the 1996 Olympics rolled into Atlanta.
So the juggernaut was a dry run, dress rehearsal for the developers and the elites to take over the city, to take over the planning, housing construction, to eliminate public housing.
Looking back, Beatty sometimes thinks she should have been prepared.
The International Olympic Committee has awarded the 1996 Olympic Games to the city of Atlanta.
Atlanta was announced as the winner. We were all here shocked. And then I got a call from our friends in Toronto who had just been successful in preventing a bid from going forward. And they said, where were you? Were you asleep?
Anita Beatty and her colleagues woke up to a relentless campaign to create an Atlanta the world would admire without reservation. The city planners figured that would have to be an Atlanta without poor people, and specifically without homeless people. So they trotted out some new laws. One would have made it a crime to remove anything from a trash can. Thousands of Atlanta's poorest residents were issued one-way bus tickets to cities where they had relatives. They had to sign papers promising they wouldn't return. Some 9,000 poor Atlantans were arrested during the 18 months before the opening ceremonies. At one point, Beatty came into possession of piles and piles of arrest citations pre-printed with the designations homeless and African American. All the arresting officer had to do was fill in a name.
And we immediately, printed it up, blew it up, put it on foam core, and had press conferences. And then we, of course, filed a lawsuit against the city. But even progressives in Atlanta were horrifyingly going along with everything and saying, y'all over there need to just chill because it's just going to last for 2 weeks and then we'll get back to normal. And we said, normal? We'll never be back to normal. And that has been absolutely true.
Authorities in Atlanta didn't go after the homeless exclusively. Olympics-related policies eliminated or repurposed whole neighborhoods. One of them was Techwood, the nation's first housing project, located in what had become prime real estate adjacent to Coca-Cola's headquarters and Georgia Tech.
Almost immediately, the idea is, well, why don't we house the Olympic athletes on part of the Techwood Clark Howell site?
MIT Urban Studies professor Lawrence Vail has written about displacements in Rio and Atlanta in a piece titled The Displacement Decathlon.
And the way it's pitched to the residents at the beginning is, oh, well, here is an opportunity to get $25,000 a unit for renovating your homes that have become rather decrepit over the decades. And then, of course, developers say, well, what are we going to look at across the street from the athletes' village? More public housing? And so it gradually expands to an idea of not renovating the apartments, but really finding a way to completely obliterate the homes of 1,200 people and to move them out of the center of Atlanta. And presumably many got to communities that were less violent and less low income than what they had been in the public housing that was in pretty terrible shape. On the other hand, they lost a great location and they lost a community that many people valued very greatly.
Elsewhere in Atlanta, despite the efforts of thousands of protesters, the neighborhood of Summerhill was sacrificed for the construction of the Olympic Stadium, which was to become the home of the Atlanta Braves, from which the Braves will shortly depart since, after only 19 years, they no longer consider that home adequate. Hosting the Olympics did serve as the catalyst for the construction of Centennial Park and eventually the Civil Rights Museum and various other downtown attractions. The area looks good now, and it looked good then, which, according to Atlanta journalist John Roosh, was precisely the point.
NBC's coverage of the Centennial Olympic Games is brought to you by IBM.
You're staging a TV show. All the city's a stage, and you have to make it look good.
But Roosh suggests looks aren't everything, or at least they shouldn't be.
It really does intrigue me that it's a scam that keeps working. And I think there is a mix, that there are some deliberately bad intentions of people who can go around and just suck money out of city after city. But I think it also just plays on people, giant developers, tycoons of various sorts, who actually think they are philanthropic. It's this dynamic that kind of enables it to keep happening.
Even so, Roush feels there's hope.
There is certainly a trend of increasing scrutiny. The gaps and cracks in the myth are starting to be seen.
And it's not just community organizers and urban planning professors who are seeing them. Toronto isn't the only city where people have turned down the opportunity to host the Games. Just last year, Boston's citizens told the politicians, developers, construction magnates, and public relations pros, thanks, but no thanks. In the wake of the rubble side of Rio, more cities may opt out of the competition. But in contemplating what he calls his fantasy world, MIT professor Lawrence Vail entertains an alternative possibility.
I wish that there was a way that people would say, okay, we're going to host the Olympics. What are the two things that our city really, really, really needs most to cope with? I'm hoping that they would share my list of those two things, which would be deal with affordable housing and deal with climate change. And that became the driving force for the kinds of investment choices. Why not really do something that embraces the opportunity to support the lowest income people and the most vulnerably situated people in a city? Wouldn't that be the Olympic spirit that we ought to embrace?
As another edition of Faster, Higher, Stronger entertains us, maybe it's an appropriate time to make that fantasy a reality and to add wiser, more just, more compassionate to that Olympic motto. There's lots more to come on Only a Game, but while you're thinking about it, consider rating us on iTunes and leaving a review. It helps other listeners find our podcast, and we always like to hear your thoughts on our show. I'm Bill Littlefield. The Olympics are officially underway in Rio, and to everybody's great surprise, the sky has not fallen into the sea, even though lots of other things have. That's where we'll begin this week's three stories you should know. Joining me this time around are the Boston Globe's Shira Springer and Patrick Ruby of Vice Sports, both via Skype. Welcome back to both of you.
Hello.
Good to be here.
Shira, as you are in Rio right now, let's start with you.
Yeah, well, I'm going to start with some of the sky is falling aspects. It's become something of an Olympic sport, I think, to predict impending doom prior to the Olympic Games. And, of course, Brazil has offered a doom predictor's paradise of sorts. We know Zika and polluted waters and violent street crime, traffic jams that stretch across the city. I've been in a few of those. Unfinished venues, I've seen a few of those. And, of course, a country in economic free fall and all of the political corruption around and about. But I'm in Rio now, about 2 miles from the Olympic Park, and I've gone running and haven't been attacked by mosquitoes, walked around at night, and actually felt pretty safe. The sky really isn't falling here in Brazil, despite alarming reports. And I understand people have to report honestly and aggressively, but I wonder if this is all fair to the host country, which I can see every time I go out trying mightily to get the games right.
Our instinct is to look for problems. Problems are news. You know, everything works fine. The trains are running on time. Isn't really news. So that's part of it. This sounds a lot like the last Olympics I went to, which was the Athens Games back in 2004. And I think in some ways, when we pay so much attention to the problems going in, we tend to ignore what I think is actually the real issue of these Olympics, which is all the problems that come out of them, and specifically just the huge amount of money that's spent, money that could have been spent on all this sort of social problems that don't go away once the rest of us leave that city.
I share your concern, but I worry that there has been so much different bad news about these Olympics that it's not all going to blow away like clouds on a nice blue sky day. Shira, I hope you'll keep us informed about the entire package as the games go on.
Yeah, and I was going to say, Bill, you're right to worry, and I don't want to give the wrong impression. As much as you want to root for the sports aspect to take over to some degree, I don't think in these particular games, some of the other concerns are going to fade away as much as they have in previous games.
In the interest of focusing on a sport at the Olympics, I want to turn our attention to a particular competition in Rio. I am rooting for the Brazilian men's soccer team to win gold, and they're not off to a great start. They had to settle for a draw in their first game. But In the semifinal of the 2014 World Cup, held right there in Brazil, the home team lost 7-1 to Germany. The score has become a kind of shorthand for failure. Grant Wall, writing for Sports Illustrated, said that when Brazil's president Dilma Rousseff was impeached, the paper said she, quote, took a 7-1. After all the bad news leading up to these Olympics, Brazil really needs a win, and no win would be more significant to them than a gold medal in soccer, which, incidentally, for all their 5 World Cups, the Brazilian men have never won. The celebration would be nationwide. It would be great. And maybe nobody needs a nationwide celebration any more than Brazil does right now. Patrick, what do you think?
I mean, look, I'm all for it. I mean, the fact that Brazil is stumbling in men's soccer, to me, in some ways, it makes me think, again, going back to the time I was in Athens, it makes me think of the United States men's basketball team in 2004, like the disgraceful team that only won the bronze medal and was like just surrounded, like, you know, every sin of American basketball was brought out to the light. And I have to imagine at some level, it's the same sort of feeling in Brazil. But I'm with you, Bill. Like, I'd like to see it. And I think you always want to see the host country enjoy some success in the games, especially when it's their national sport. Let them have something.
I will root for Marta and the Brazilian women in the women's tournament. But I'm sorry, I cannot get off the Nigeria bandwagon at this point. This is a team that got stranded in Atlanta for a variety of reasons, including the fact that their national federation booked a plane that was too small and there may or may not have been an unpaid bill in there. Nigeria arrived hours before its opening match against Japan, and they won. They beat Japan 5-4. So I'm sorry, you have got to root for Nigeria.
Patrick, it's time for your story. I know because I read your stuff. You've been thinking about the war on performance-enhancing drugs lately, which, gee whiz, may be another Olympic issue.
Right. So, my story this week is one of my favorite and most chronically unappreciated writers, who that would be me. It's called The Drugs Won, The Case for Ending the Sports War on Doping. Now, before you say it's crazy or morally wrong, or that we're going to end up like the old Saturday Night Live all-drug Olympic skit where Kevin Nealon's arms explode in blood, we test and we police, and we're failing. We're failing miserably. We do an awful job of catching athletes who are trying to cheat. So while we're not deterring use, we're not catching users, but what we are doing, and this is the case with every drug prohibition, we push stuff underground. And what happens when you do that? You create a climate for corruption and extortion. The stuff you see going on in Russia right now. Arguably as well, this prohibition is making athletes less safe because the ones who are going to use, you're being steered toward these sketchy underground chemists as well as risky experimental drugs that are harder to detect. And there's a lot of people are saying, hold on, slow down, let's stop, let's rethink, and let's manage this issue the way we manage medicine. Look, most of these drugs are first and foremost medicines. They all have potentially bad side effects. They can be abused, but they also could be used and used safely or relatively safely under responsible medical supervision. So let's do that.
Patrick had me sort of until he started to talk about how we should use this the way we use other medicines. Because I think once you get into that and you have athletes sort of medicating themselves with these performance-enhancing drugs, you have even more sort of inequality in the playing field, because you have some athletes who are going to have access to the latest science and technology and medical services, so to speak, and some from the less well-off, less organized countries who won't. But I do think that the entire anti-doping movement has to be reevaluated, and we have to really look more closely at how we police performance-enhancing drug use at all levels of sport. And I think the main problem, and this has been said over and over by sports leaders, is you have people in policing the sport who are also in charge of promoting the sport. So I think before we sort of give up entirely, declare victory and move on, I think in the words of Doug Logan, which you quoted in your article, Patrick, I think we need to first really seriously make an attempt at a third party being involved in the policing of drug use in sport.
What it boils down to for me is whether the drug testers and the people who decide the penalties for the people who get caught are doing more harm than good and creating more hypocrisy than they are honesty. And that is an ongoing question that I suppose we'll continue to explore. Patrick, you want to wrap this up for us?
The whole idea behind this change in the drug policy would be to reduce harm. It would be to make things better, but it certainly would not make things perfect. It's something where the genie's out of the box, and the genie's only getting bigger, by the way. We're not that far probably from gene doping, which essentially is going to be
unpoliceable. Oh, yes, I think you're right.
And once that happens, we're going to have to rethink this.
My guests for this week's three stories you should know have been the Boston Globe Shira Springer and Patrick Ruby of Vice Sports. Thank you both.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you.
You'll find the city of Twinsburg, Ohio, about halfway between Cleveland and Akron. And if you were to visit Twinsburg this weekend, you would find thousands of pairs of twins attending the 41st annual Twins Days Festival. Organizers call it the largest gathering of twins anywhere in the world. You might know about the festival already, it's somewhat well known, but you probably don't know that Only a Game's Bob Schaefer is an identical twin, and for as long as he can remember, Bob has had a question in the back of his mind. It has to do with identical twins and sports. Here's Bob.
I'm 8 years old, and I'm watching my brother Bill play first base. It's hot and humid, and bees are buzzing around the trash can next to me. I only hear the bees. I'm not watching them or the baseball game. I just got to the part where Harry finds out the truth about Sirius Black.
I remember that you would sometimes bring a book to my baseball games. I do vaguely remember seeing you on the stands with a book.
That's Bill, my identical twin. My mom didn't quite know what to make of us.
I did worry, and I, as a mother, always wondered if you were truly happy sitting there reading your book, because you certainly didn't look excited as you're sitting there reading a book.
Bill and I have always had our simple go-to answers for when people ask how different we are. Bill plays the drums and thinks Iron Man is the best. I play the saxophone and know that Batman is better. But these small differences were all conscious choices we made as we grew up. When it came to sports, Bill was always naturally talented. I was not. On the rare occasions I would get out on the field, we'd be on the same teams with the same coaches, and Bill would still be better. What gives? Aren't we supposed to be identical? Is this normal, or am I a bad identical twin?
No, you're certainly not a bad identical twin at all.
That's Nancy Siegel, and she was just being polite, because her research seems to suggest that Bill and I shouldn't be as different athletically as we appear to be. Siegel is a professor of developmental psychology at California State University Fullerton. She is also the founder and director of the Twins Studies Center. Siegel says compared to fraternals, identicals are much more alike when it comes to the physical attributes that determine sports ability. Things like muscle fibers and how much oxygen your body takes in. And actually, Siegel says the athletic similarities seem to go beyond just physical traits.
What strikes me about other identical twins I've seen on sports fields is that they really have an uncanny knowledge of what the other one is about to do or what the other one is about to think.
So identical twins are practically matched down to the muscle fiber, and they're also supposed to think the same way on the field. If these things are true, then why was I reading Harry Potter instead of playing sports? I thought a pro might have some answers. Robin Lopez is a center for the Chicago Bulls, and he's an identical twin. His brother Brooke also is a center in the NBA. He plays for the Brooklyn Nets. So we have 2 7-foot identical twin brothers playing in the NBA. I didn't have a ton of hope that Robin would make me feel better about my situation. But I needed to know, when it comes to basketball, I guess, is there anything you can do that he can't?
I think there are a lot of things. I think I'm better than him defensively, maybe rebounding, particularly offensively. I think he's a better scorer, better shooter. He's more of a threat to go to work on the block. He has a wider array of offensive moves.
So while Robin and Brooke are talented enough to play in the NBA, they are good at different things. Maybe, I thought, I'm not such an unusual identical twin after all. But Why are Robin and Brooks so different?
I think it's that we both wanted to share the court. We wanted to be able to play together at the same time. So our games are very complementary in that sense.
In other words, Brooke and Robin weren't born with these athletic differences. They created them. Bill and I never tried to be athletically different. We just always were. It's been like that since kindergarten. That's when I remembered something twin researcher Nancy Siegel had told me.
Identical twins are not strictly identical.
Well, that could explain some things.
The reason for that is a lot of events can happen after the fertilized egg is formed that will make identical twins differ. For example, there can be individual mutations in one twin, not the other. I'm actually surprised identical twins are as alike as they are behaviorally and physically, given all the many influences that can work to make them different.
This was big. Now I had a possible explanation for my athletic deficiencies. I'm clearly a mutant twin. My genes just have more mutations than Bill's, and that's what's causing our athletic differences. I needed to dig a little deeper into this idea. Am I weird?
No, I don't think you're weird.
Hermine Maz is an associate professor at Virginia Commonwealth University and the Virginia Institute for Psychiatric and Behavioral Genetics. She explained that while identical twins can have genetic mutations, they still tend to be much more genetically similar than not. In fact, Maz says those mutations barely make a difference when it comes to athleticism. What does make a difference? Forces from the outside environment.
These are just the sort of slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. Certain things happen to you that influence you, but only you, and the same with your brother.
When she says slings and arrows, think differences in training. Maz thinks any perceived athletic differences between Bill and me is a result of the time he spent on the field while I was reading. But I wasn't reading Harry Potter in kindergarten, and Bill has always been better than me at sports. If we were to compete against one another, would there be differences there? Is that what you would expect?
Not necessarily. It would be interesting to study anyway, but I mean, likely on certain aspects that are sort of more basic underlying factors that determine whether or not you're good at sports, I would expect that you probably aren't all that different.
Maz said if we tested more basic skills like sprinting or jumping instead of specifics like shooting foul shots, that we should be even. Again, this was hard for me to accept. So producers Karen Given, Martin Kessler, intern Ian Foster, and I decided we had to put Maz's theory to the test. If Bill and I faced off in feats of natural athleticism, would we see real differences? Or, as Maz thought, would we be practically the same? First up, a 75-yard dash.
You guys have a similar running gait, I gotta say.
Totally.
To everyone's shock, I win the dash. But I'm thinking it's probably just a fluke. After sprinting comes 75 yards of running backwards. It's tough. Bill takes that one. And honestly, I'm glad. Who wants to brag that they can run backwards really well? We're tied 1-1 with 3 events to go. Next up is the long jump. Again, Bill wins. This thing is starting to go sideways just like I knew it would. But Karen and Martin found a test on the internet for balance, and that's an innate skill. Suddenly, I come back. Bill loses.
That doesn't count.
At this point, Bill and I are exhausted, and the contest is all tied up again.
It's almost like you guys have similar genes.
Martin has a really good point. Is that the answer? We have one more event. Arm wrestling, best of 3. Bill ends up winning.
He's so defeated.
That was tough.
Also so sweaty.
I was so sweaty because, to my surprise, arm wrestling took a really long time. In one round, our arms didn't budge for almost 30 seconds. Bill won the twin pentathlon, but only 3-2. I was honestly shocked. Years of belief were shattered, and I can confidently say that Bill is no longer the more athletically gifted twin. He might be slightly more skilled, but I'm certainly not unathletic like I always thought I was. And I'm definitely not a bad or abnormal identical twin when it comes to athletics, which is good to know. Maybe I should have started caring about sports when I was a kid. I mean, I could have at least played Quidditch. For Only Game, I'm Bob Schaefer.
We'll be right back with Charlie Pierce and more sports NPR style Next week on the show, the tale of a Swedish Olympian who had to run from the Nazis before she could swim for gold. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up next week on Only a Game, whatever happened to the perfect 10 in gymnastics? But right now, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce this week for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
The Rio Summer Games are underway, and according to the Russian Olympic Committee, that nation has, quote, the cleanest team. They also have had over 100 athletes banned just before the games began. So which is it?
Well, I don't know, but I don't think any team is going to be clean once they jump into that bay.
Ooh.
But that's neither here nor there. No, I mean, nobody believes the Russians, and I don't care anymore. This Olympics already has had so many things go wrong with it. I think a partially drugged up Russian team is the least of its problems.
I have read two stories asserting that things aren't as bad as anticipated in Rio, at least as regards safety for the athletes and the paying customers. Maybe they couldn't have been.
I think that's probably the case. I still think they don't belong there. I don't think they ever belong there. I wish they had been removed from there. I wish the International Olympic Committee would get up off its honorary of fat and duffs and put a permanent site together someplace. In Sports Illustrated last week, I suggested Omaha. It's a nice place in the middle. It's nice and flat. Got lakes, got rivers you can do the stuff on. Anyway, I mean, I'm not married to the idea of Omaha being a permanent site. I'm just suggesting that it might be a good one.
There are lots of ways to cope with inconveniences and distractions built into the Olympics in Rio, Charlie. It seems the men's and women's U.S. basketball teams have been handed a dandy one, don't you think?
Yes, they're going to be living on a luxury cruise ship. This is not unprecedented, by the way. This happened in, I believe, in Athens, too. Can't they at least put, you know, the team handball guys and the fencers in, you know, steerage or something? I mean...
The IOC announced this week the addition of five sports to the 2020 Games in Tokyo. Baseball and softball are back. Does this delight you?
Not particularly, no. I mean, softball, yes. Yeah. Softball actually turned out to be a lot of fun. Yeah, we're starting to slide toward the X Games again. There's skateboarding and surfing. And there's also karate and sport climbing, which I presume is one of those walls that they have at, you know, outdoor stores where kids climb up the wall so they're not knocking things off shelves. You know, I don't know. I mean, I think sport climbing is getting pretty far from the original spirit of the Olympic
I'd
Games, but
say,
what do
right.
I know?
The Chicago Cubs are still the best team in the bigs, according to all sorts of statistical measures that I don't understand, and also according to the standings. It's August. Should I not mention this at all?
Oh, it's happening. It's all happening, Bill. And I do like the fact that you're maintaining that the really most important statistic is whether you're in first place
well,
or not.
Well, it is.
The Cubs are showing remarkable staying power. When I went out there earlier this year to watch them play, they're built to last. And Theo Epstein, I think, is making a judicious use of his minor league talent to fill in the holes in his roster. And there's absolutely no reason to believe that they can't keep this going, except, of course, that they're the Chicago Cubs.
Umpires throw players out of games. Sometimes they throw managers out of games. And this week, an umpire threw a fan out of a game. And I bet you're not surprised that it happened in Philadelphia.
No, of course not. But get over yourself, umpire. I mean, give me a break.
You're there to be yelled at.
You're throwing a fan out because he said bad things to you? Bob Davidson, guess what? You know, you don't work for the CIA. Your job is not that important. But part of your job is to stand there and take it.
Meanwhile, I have to say to young men and women who want to begin their careers as baseball writers by covering minor league teams, good luck. Help me to understand how and why those jobs may be taken over by machines.
I do not know.
Oh.
I do not know.
I was hoping you had the answer.
I am the analyst 101.
I wish you knew.
I am the analyst 201.
Now I am lost. I do not know
what
to say.
Yeah, the AP is going to use something called automated writing to cover the minor leagues, which is not, by the way, the same thing as automatic writing, which is the way you communicate
with
the dead. With the dead, exactly. In this case, you're going to be communicating with your dead audience, but you're going to be doing it by robotic. First of all, who's going to run the no-hitter pool?
And the one good thing will be, you know, when the letters come in, oh, man, that was a lousy article you wrote. It's going to be, I am sorry, I will try to do better next week.
And who are baseball players going to call maggots? Machines? They don't care.
That's right. Ted Williams would have been utterly bereft of things to say.
He wouldn't have been I'll tell you, he wouldn't have been half the hitter he was if this had been the case.
The GOP mascot is an elephant, of course. Why does the party's candidate for a seat in the Michigan House of Representatives have a rhinoceros on his yard sign?
Because the winner of the Republican primary for a seat in the Michigan State Legislature is a WWE wrestler named Rhino.
Sure.
Whose actual real name is Terrence Guerin. And he won, and he said some interesting things on his issues page on his website, one of them being, one thing I learned early on in wrestling is that you get sponsors. That way your bills are paid before you even sell one ticket. This guy has a career in politics like you wouldn't believe.
Finally, Charlie, celebrated Japanese gymnast Kohai Uchimura has been penalized thousands of dollars for his performance in a sport that's not gymnastics. How can this be?
Yeah, Kohai somehow wasn't briefed before he went to Rio on the concept of roaming charges. He was doing very, very, very well playing Pokemon Go in Rio and then got a roaming charge on his cell phone totaling ½ million yen. Which is almost $5,000 in American dough. And one of his teammates said he looked dead at the team meal that day.
I hope he recovers before he has to compete. That would be a shame.
Actually, his carrier in Japan has reduced his expenses to about $30 American because what the hell, it's the Olympics.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated, and he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
The Olympics are supposed to bring people of the world together, standing side by side, hand in hand, united in the spirit of healthy competition. But that's not what happened during the 1924 Olympic rugby final between France and the United States. And the events of that day helped keep rugby out of the Olympic program for the next 92 years. Only a Game's Karen Given has our story.
The United States is the defending Olympic rugby champion. Let that sink in for a bit. The U.S. wasn't known for playing rugby back in 1924 any more than it is today. And yet, the United States is the defending Olympic rugby champion. But this isn't just a David versus Goliath story. This is also a story about the turbulent times between world wars, as two countries that had fought on the winning side squabbled over how to treat the losers. But back to rugby. Right after the turn of the 20th century, rugby was briefly more popular than American football, at least in the state of California.
Stanford and California abandoned American football after, I think it was 1906, because during the previous season there had been 19 casualties in football. The game had gotten so rough and there was not adequate protection.
That's Norman Cleveland, a Stanford man who played on the 1924 Olympic team. And when I say that's Norman Cleveland, I actually mean that's actor Walter Dixon, reading Norman Cleveland's words from an oral history held by the Bancroft Library in Berkeley, California. The real Norman Cleveland died in 1997. Rugby was already on its way out when the U.S. team won Olympic gold at the 1920 Games in Antwerp. After World War I, American college athletes would play American football. Dangers be damned. And by 1924, when the Olympics would be held in Paris, finding American athletes with competitive experience at the sport was difficult. Even so,
France, whom the United States defeated for the title in 1920, was very insistent that the title holder enter a team so that she might be given the opportunity to remove the laurel wreath from the crown of her dear brothers from the USA.
That's actor Mark Baumhart, reading from the Journal of Dudley DeGroot. DeGroot died in 1970, but his account of his time with the Olympic rugby team was printed by the Call newspaper over 23 days, starting in July 1924.
They were looking for a punching bag? We were told to go to Paris and take our beatings like gentlemen.
Norman Cleveland again, this time in an interview with rugby expert Mark Jenkins. If France had won guaranteed gold in the 1924 Olympics, it was in rugby. But just to make sure, Olympic organizers scheduled the games for 2 months before the rest of the events, at a time when French rugby players would be in top form. That put the Americans on a tight schedule. A few of the players from 1920 decided to return to the team, and open tryouts filled out the roster. All of the players came from California, and they had all played more American football than rugby. In early April, the team made their way to New York and set sail on the SS America, bound not for Paris, but for England, where they would play practice matches against English teams, considered by many to be the best in the world.
Certainly, any group of Americans had a great deal of nerve to travel some 6,000 miles to play the greatest English teams at a game which, in every sense of the word, is English. But how much greater, or foolish, that nerve when it is considered that American team had never played a game as a unit, nor had any of the members of the team played rugby for 4 years, while 8 of them had never played a game in their lives. And in spite of our confidence in ourselves, we often wondered whether we had not undertaken something a little bit bigger than we could handle.
Okay, so you might be wondering, if England was the best in the world at rugby, why wasn't Great Britain sending a team across the channel to the Olympics? I mean, easy trip, right? In De Groot's journal, he asks the same thing. And Great Britain wasn't the only team missing. The only two countries that agreed to face France in the Olympic rugby tournament were the United States and Romania. Everyone else stayed home, not because they were afraid to face the French team. They were afraid of the French fans. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Our plucky American rugby team lands in England, where they get a good drubbing from the great English rugby teams. And then, after 6 days, it's time to board another boat.
Rough. Oh, I've never been on such a rough ride. We were seasick, and we felt battered around. Well, the French had goofed off, and they hadn't told the officials in Boulogne that we were coming, so they said we couldn't get off the boat. We didn't have any visas. So we said, "That's what you think. You watch us. See if we get off this boat." We charged through the gendarmes and through the barriers. The next morning, the Paris papers featured the big riot in Boulogne. Oh, we were really taken apart in the press.
The rugby players settled into their hotel in Paris. The athletes' village wasn't ready yet and started preparing for the 3-game tournament. First up, France v. Romania. The American team watched that one from the stands.
The final score of that game, if game it could be called, was 61-8 in favor of France. We left the field fully realizing just what we were up against. A decidedly sober bunch of Americans trying to figure out just how we were going to stop that French backfield.
That France would beat Romania was a surprise to no one. The tournament had been scheduled so that the U.S. and France would likely both have one win over Romania before they met in the last game of the series. So it should have been a surprise to no one that when the U.S. played Romania, the French fans were decidedly anti-American.
To say that the French spectators were unsportsmanlike at that game would be putting it far too mildly.
The French Olympic Committee agreed. In the days before the final, they published an appeal in a local newspaper for civility in the wake of the violent sentiments shown by the French fans. The Americans play hard, the committee admitted, but never brutally or with bad intent. The Californians, who have come over 12,000 kilos to play a sport which is not theirs, should have the applause and the feeling of the French sporting public.
It is hard to conceive of a nation so unsportsmanlike that such an appeal is necessary. But it's harder still to try to understand how the people of the French nation could be so hostile to representatives of a country which had so recently saved them from almost certain destruction.
Rugby and rugby fans would take the blame for the events that followed. But there was a subtext here. Not only did Americans like De Groot feel that the French owed the U.S. a debt of gratitude, but there was a feeling among the French that the U.S. and Great Britain had abandoned France, at least financially, after the war. All of that was in play when on a blistering hot and humid Sunday in May, 40,000 fans packed Colombe Stadium in Paris.
As we were standing at attention during the playing of our anthem, the storm, which had been threatening all day, broke loose with a tremendous clap of thunder and a burst of lightning which enhanced the majesty of the scene many times.
The odds were 5-1 against us. We really had our dander up. A lot of things we knew about playing American football, the French were yet to learn.
They did most of their tackling around the neck and shoulders. Consequently, when we left our feet and hit them low, it simply laid them out. The French fullback was a particularly dirty player, persisting in putting his cleated foot in your face. We soon found by tackling him hard and low on the one leg he kept on the ground, he soon got over this. From that time on, that fullback couldn't kick the ball when he got it to save his life.
Oh, we gave them a waxing. But they started beating up Americans in the stands. This was during the game. The only way they could get the injured Americans into an ambulance was to bring them onto the field. We thought that some were dead, and we thought that it was only a matter of time before we would be dead also. But anyway, we won, 17-3.
After the game, the French crowd only got more unruly. The headline in the San Francisco Examiner the next day read, "French boo U.S. anthem." But in France, a different narrative altogether started to emerge.
The French newspapers switched sides, changed their role 180 degrees, and we became great heroes. And Paris, I can assure you, is one of the best places in the world to be a hero.
Norman Cleveland stayed behind for a while to enjoy being a hero in Europe. Dudley DeGroot got to work on his 21-part journal for The Call. He ended not on a note of reconciliation, but on one that questioned whether the Olympics should be held at all.
Where will it end? Certainly the French need to be taught true sportsmanship, which is one of the objects of the Olympic Games. But such a thing seems to be an impossibility.
Rugby sevens, the game that will be played in Rio, is faster paced and higher scoring than the game of 15s that DeGroot and Cleveland played. And rugby's popularity is on a worldwide upswing. Neither France nor the U.S. is expected to medal at these games. But wouldn't it be cool if the U.S. team entered the first Olympic rugby tournament since 1924 as an underdog and came out champions? Nah, that would never happen. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Martin Kessler. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. We had help this week from Alex Schroeder and from Bob Schaefer. Special thanks to Dave Schultz for sending us some of his research into the 1924 Olympic rugby team. Our intern is Ian Foster and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word this week comes from actor Walter Dixon. Oh, sorry, Walter. Super Bowl haiku is not for another 6 months, but hey, it's great that you're practicing. You just can't hold down those hut-hut haiku players. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports, NPR style on Only a Game. Thanks for listening.